For South Carolina Public Radio, I'm Bradley Fuller. When discovering or maybe rediscovering music, it can help to have a friendly face in front of you. Or at least a not-so-unfriendly face. For musicologist and author Mark Evan Bonds, listeners would do well to get past a certain pervasive image of the composer Ludwig van Beethoven. Evan, who is a Cary C. Bosshammer Distinguished Professor of Music at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, has written books spanning everything from general music appreciation for undergraduates to scholarly works such as The Beethoven Syndrome, Hearing Music as Autobiography. Recently, I had a chance to speak with Evan about Beethoven's perceived scowl, as well as other topics he covers in his book, Beethoven: Variations on a Life. Here's the conversation we had. Evan, really great to have you today.
Thanks. Good to be here.
You know, with the 250th anniversary of Ludwig van Beethoven's birth upon us, it seems like a good time not only to listen to some of his music, but also to reflect on his life and legacy, and maybe in doing so, to approach his music anew. I was struck by one of the lines in the book you've written, Beethoven: Variations on a Life, that there are no right or wrong ways to listen to Beethoven's music, but some are more accommodating than others. The first thing to get past is the scowl. And you have both of those words capitalized. What is the scowl?
The scowl is the image we see of Beethoven almost all the time. He's frowning. He looks very serious. His eyebrows are down. The corners of his mouth are down. He's obviously wrestling with something internally. That's an image of Beethoven that really didn't exist until after his death. If you look at portraits of him made during his lifetime, he looks serious, as one would expect. There aren't too many portraits from that period of anyone smiling. But he doesn't look unhappy. He looks as if he's got a purpose, but there's no scowl. That's simply not there until later. And I think the scowl came in gradually in response to some of his most famous pieces, like the Fifth Symphony, you know, with its opening of fate knocking at the door, da-da-da-dum, and the Ninth Symphony with its ode to joy, this sense of struggle and triumph in the end, the heroic Beethoven. That's the immediate response people have when you say the word Beethoven, is a heroic figure. And the scowl, I have to say, does fit some of his music, like the Fifth Symphony, like the Eroica, the heroic symphony. But it doesn't fit most of his music. And if you go back to people who knew him during his lifetime and look at their correspondence, there are many references to him laughing. He was really just an incorrigible punster. He would often take people's names and play with them and sometimes do permutations on them, sort of scramble the letters around and see how many different words he could make out of one name. And so this suggests a personality that's really very different from the one that's come down to us. And when I say more accommodating ways of listening, it's a way of hearing lesser known works in a way that fits. You know, take for example the Eroica Symphony. Again, that's Opus 55. If you look at Opus 54, the work he published immediately before, it's a two-movement piano sonata that's just full of jokes and lively and fun, and really the finale takes your breath away. It's a perpetuum mobile. And it couldn't possibly be more different from the Eroica Symphony. So I think as an individual, he was really much more multifaceted than this scowl with which he is so often portrayed.
And there were certain events in his life which really reached widespread public awareness after his death. You know, the famous Heiligenstadt Testament of 1802, in which he says that art is basically saving him from total despair. And about 10 years after that, you had the letter to his immortal beloved. And you mentioned these being discovered in a drawer after his death. Did these two documents contribute to this image of someone who is totally tortured all the time, you know, to the point that all the lighthearted works got swept under the rug, and it all becomes about this utter struggle?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. And I think it is significant that these two documents were not known during his lifetime, but became instantly known. They were translated into many languages right away as soon as they were discovered. And when you think about it, his contemporaries, unless they happened to live in Vienna and happened to be in the circle of musicians and members of the court who might have known Beethoven personally, it's a very small number of people. Outside of that very small circle, people across Europe really didn't know much about him. They knew he existed. They knew he was writing music. They heard his music, and they responded to his music, but he was really not much more than a name. They really didn't have any way of knowing about him. The earliest public mention of his deafness didn't come until the late 1810s. And that's isolated, you know, how many people happen to have read that one reference. So it really was only in the very last years of his life that people even knew he was going deaf. So public reception at the time, I think, has something to teach us about how to listen to his music today. We can't unlearn or forget what we know about him as an individual. But as I say, I think if we recognize that he's much more multifaceted than this caricatured image of the scowl, we can really get a lot more out of his music.
You mentioned earlier about his love for wordplay and these permutations, toying with things. You know, you think about the motif at the start of the Fifth Symphony, the da-da-da-dum. He really does have this craftsman way of considering things from many angles, working out the implications of a single small idea like that. Now, even if he does work those out, though, with a lot in the way of emotion and powerful feeling, you'd say that this tendency to impart a super autobiographical quality to his music, to understand a certain piece as a diary entry, that this understanding came later and that Beethoven himself didn't really consider that his purpose or the purpose of any artist, did he?
No, and really no composer did until after Beethoven. After Beethoven's death, this idea that music is an outpouring of the soul, I don't want to say it's wrong, because, I mean, anything we do, even trivial things, bears our imprint. You know, our fingerprints are on it. So I don't want to discount that entirely. But Beethoven really, I think it's probably more accurate to think of him as a sort of parallel to Shakespeare. You know, Shakespeare could write comedies, he could write tragedies, he could write histories, he could write sonnets. He did all these things, you know, really that really encompass pretty much the whole spectrum of human emotions. And Beethoven, I think, was very much like that, that he saw himself, he called himself a tone poet. Tondichter is the German word. It's a single word, as the Germans like to do, pack things together. So he was writing poetry in tones, in music, purely instrumental music. And I think that's the way he saw himself. And a poet, at least before the Romantic age, poets were seen as craftsmen who could represent and evoke a wide variety of emotions. We might also think about actors. Certain actors really are able to play a lot of different roles. I mean, you think about all the different roles Tom Hanks or Robert De Niro have played, as opposed to, say, Arnold Schwarzenegger. Nobody would call him a great actor. He's terrific in the roles he plays because it's a very specific type of role. He's very limited in what he can portray. A good actor can portray all kinds of different roles. And I think that's what Beethoven was able to do. That's why the music that we think of as maybe not heroic Beethoven is still by Beethoven, and we have to recognize that.
So you might take some issue with this quotation, which I'll reverse the order of. Bach tells you what it's like to be the universe, Mozart tells you what it's like to be human, and Beethoven tells you what it's like to be Beethoven. Maybe that's not the best way of looking at the situation.
Well, again, there's no wrong way of listening to it. But I think Beethoven can tell you a lot about the universe too, and a lot about humanity. It's a more accommodating way of listening. It doesn't limit us so much.
And he certainly saw that as his calling. He recognized he had this phenomenal talent, and no matter what his struggles were, and there were some very serious struggles there, it was his duty to make the best art that he could in service to humanity, yes, but also, as he believed, to God.
Yes, he had a very strong sense of mission, and this comes through in so many of his letters. Not always in so many words, but he was constantly struggling to find the time to compose. And it's really astonishing that he wrote as much as he did, considering that he did not have a steady income. Unlike many other contemporary composers and most composers of the previous generation, he did not have a job at a court or at a church. And so he really had to cobble together a living from the compositions he sold, the occasional lessons that he gave. He hated teaching because, not because he hated teaching, but because it was an imposition on his time. This really shaped a lot of his life. And I think it's one of the reasons he never married, even if he had been able to find a woman who would have him. I think he knew at some level that that meant a commitment to something other than his art. And he really felt that he had all of this music inside of him that he had to get out before he died. And he says as much in the Heiligenstadt Testament of 1802. And he did. One wonders what would have happened had he lived a little longer, but at least he didn't go as young as Mozart and Schubert did.
Definitely. And there does seem to be a certain finality with his Ninth Symphony. Obviously, he could have written past that, but certainly in some of those later works, he seems to have reached a pretty satisfactory, to understate things a bit, stopping point, a striking stopping point. But then again, is that just my view after the fact? Could he have gone even further into some late period?
Yeah, well, I think what you're saying makes sense. He himself, I think, still had more in him yet to write. He did, in fact, write some works after the Ninth Symphony, and those are some of his most difficult, both to perform and to hear. He wrote music that was so unconventional that listeners of his time just really couldn't quite keep up with it, and they ascribed it to the fact that he was deaf, which of course is nonsense, because while it's very difficult to perform when you're deaf, it's not that hard to compose when you're deaf. I mean, he heard it in his head what he was doing, and I think what he was doing ultimately was challenging listeners and engaging them, and in a way paying them a compliment, you know, to put something out there that's difficult, that really demanded interpretation in a way that other music did not. I'm not saying other music was not intricate and sophisticated, but his was intricate and sophisticated to such a degree that listeners really had trouble relating it to anything they had heard before. And that comes through in the critical responses to his late music. And it's kind of interesting because the late quartets, for example, which are among the very last things he wrote, were really not very much appreciated for really almost 75, 80, getting on 90 years. It was only in the early 20th century, really, that those works began to come into their own, because they really have this modern quality to them. And so it took time to come to terms with these works, but I'm happy to say that now we've done it, and now they're valued as among his greatest of all his works.
Though even before Beethoven reached that point of his career, even some of his earlier works still occasionally met with some pushback or surprise with those audiences who weren't used to, you mentioned, having to make this special effort to listen to music, that was something new in Beethoven's time.
Yes. The interesting thing, I think, is that the Eroica Symphony, again, to come back to that once more, was a work that at first people just thought was ridiculous. You know, it was twice as long as any symphony that had ever been written. So just in terms of endurance, you know, they were put out at how much had been thrust upon them. But within a couple of years, the Eroica was the piece that everybody wanted to hear. So yes, there was pushback, but people caught up with it very quickly. The late works were an exception in that regard, but his early and middle period works, he was really a very popular composer during his lifetime. Only at the end did people really begin to lose track of what he was doing. But he had written so much at that point that he was really a celebrity. I mean, everybody knew who he was, not just musicians, but everybody. At his funeral, there were, you know, an estimated tens of thousands of people at his funeral. He was a rock star by the time he died. He would have just as soon been left alone and have people let him have his piece so that he could compose, but he was a celebrity.
Well, and certainly that fame has continued unabated right through the later 19th century, when you have different camps of romantic composers kind of debating his legacy and the right way to fill his shoes, if there is any way to fill his shoes. And then in the 20th and 21st centuries, you know, the fame is still there. And now when we talk about Beethoven, it's not just Beethoven the man or Beethoven the music, but also everything that's blossomed from that, this whole celebrity culture around Beethoven, maybe even a cult of Beethoven since then. And one line in your book, Beethoven, Variations on a Life, that struck me, you mentioned pushback against Beethoven has been strongest around the time of anniversaries. So here we are with one now. What's 2020 looking like from your view? Obviously a little different given the pandemic and all, but any pushback this year?
Not as much as there might have been had the celebration actually taken place. I mean, personally, I had, I don't know, 3 or 4 or 5 various lectures and conferences and things canceled. So some of it was done remotely, but it's not the same thing. And of course, no live performances. It's an interesting year. It's been an interesting year because we haven't had the same type of commemoration. I'm old enough to remember the one from 1970, and I can remember very well. By the time we got to December 16th, 1970, everybody was sick of Beethoven. There'd been so much of it. It was like, let's get this over with. Maybe because of the pandemic and the isolation we've all been experiencing. I don't personally have that sense now. There's some of it in the online chatter, but it doesn't seem quite as intense.
Do you have any sense of one maybe especially troubling part of, say, Beethoven in quotation marks, this cult of Beethoven, the Beethoven brand, what that might be? Or maybe do you have any thoughts about any particular aspect of his legacy that might be put to the side so that we can more appropriately engage with or even enjoy his music more?
Well, I think it gets back to trying to take a more holistic approach to the man and to his music, because I think it's this heroic quality, or this perceived heroic quality, which is present in a few of his works. I'm not denying it, but it's a very small, relatively small number of works, just happens to be his most famous ones. I think that it's that heroic quality that people become uncomfortable with. And I can understand that. I think what we might do is remind ourselves that this is, I hesitate to use the word caricature because it's there. You know, these works are real. They're actually there. But it's an exaggeration of one facet of one type of work that he wrote. And if we look at the whole output, what I always marvel at is the incredible variety. The vocal music, I mean, you know, that just doesn't get performed very much. You know, the opera, Fidelio, the two settings of the Mass, an oratorio, many, many songs. And the songs are just wonderful, but kind of overshadowed by Schubert. But I think that if we looked at the whole of his output, I think it would create a different impression of him. This heroic ideal is something that generations after him have run with. He himself said virtually nothing about his own music, ever. He really, and he declined to do so. I mean, he made an active attempt not to get involved in critical controversies. He just put his music out there and sort of had the attitude, you know, let people make of it what they will. And there has been this unfortunate tendency to, I think, overemphasize this heroic aspect of his music and by extension of him. And I think in both cases, it's really not as on the mark as it might be.
Well, I'm sure plenty of people will be listening to his Symphony No. 3 for the marking of this anniversary. But do you have any works that aren't so in the heroics, maybe some personal favorites that you might recommend as a remedy to this excessively heroic culture and maybe showcase a different side of the composer and his music?
I would refer again to the Opus 54 Piano Sonata, which is in two movements. It's a very short sonata. It starts out as if it were a minuet, a very kind of stately, courtly dance. And then all the wheels fall off the wagon and it goes into this frantic kind of episode. And then it goes back to a minuet. And it's almost like a Jekyll and Hyde kind of thing that goes back and forth. And then this perpetual motion finale is just a lot of fun. Even the symphonies. I mean, what are the two most overlooked symphonies? The fourth and the eighth. And especially the eighth, I think, is just full of... the word I keep thinking of when I hear it is zany. In the first movement, he's got this one rhythmic pattern that he repeats. Well, music's full of repetition. That's nothing unusual. And then he repeats it again. Okay. And then again, and again, and again, and so on. And he repeats it so many times that it almost becomes a parody of itself. It's as if the music has gotten stuck in itself. And it's funny. And it's a different, side of him. It's a different side of his music. So those are two works in particular I would recommend.
I think the striped quality of his symphonies, if you will, what many describe as the contrasting nature of his odd and even numbered symphonies, however far you can go with that, I think that is a testament to this well-rounded, shape-shifting quality that you mentioned Beethoven has. It seems that even in the works he wrote in the way that they were released to the public, it's not this continuous line, but more of a checkerboard, that whether he intended this or not, it really does show his versatility as an artist.
That's a really good point. And the fifth and sixth symphonies, the sixth is known as the Pastoral, is a great example of that. He wrote these two works pretty much at the same time, you know, one working on one in the morning and one in the afternoon, as it were, and premiered them at the same concert. And they couldn't possibly be more different. They're two completely contrasting approaches to the genre of the symphony itself. One is absolute music. It has no program. We talk about fate pounding at the door, but that's from later. That's not from Beethoven. And the other is a programmatic symphony with five movements instead of the usual four, and a kind of narrative through its titles, the titles of each movement. Seventh and Eighth Symphonies were also written at more or less the same time. I think it was a way of allowing his versatility, as you put it, to come out. This is a kind of theme running through Variations on a Life, and you've mentioned it already. The idea that he liked to look at any given object from multiple perspectives, whether it's his own deafness, love, money, politics, composing, all of these things, he was constantly moving, surveying and trying to figure out, okay, what are the possibilities with this little thing? And you can hear that in his music too. He'll take something as nugatory as da-da-da-dum, you know, that little motive, and do so much with it. I mean, it's only two notes, but it's what he does with those two notes that's so remarkable.
And in keeping with that ability to really explore an idea and approach something from a lot of different angles, Beethoven seems to have been a pretty voracious consumer of literature, philosophy. You mentioned Shakespeare earlier. Beethoven was a huge fan of the Bard. I wanted to ask if there was any non-musical figure, so not Mozart or Haydn, but anyone from outside the realm of music whose work might go the longest way in helping us better understand Beethoven. Any poet or literary figure, philosopher, political theorist?
Interesting question. He loved and admired Goethe, met him, in fact, Goethe being sort of the German equivalent of Shakespeare. I think a maybe more provocative answer would be Napoleon, because he never met Napoleon, but had a very complicated relationship to him, you know, alternating at times from viewing Napoleon as the savior of mankind, you know, someone who was really going to create a society based on liberty, equality, and fraternity, And then at other times, feeling that he was just like all the others, you know, that he crowned himself emperor. He was no longer first consul. He was emperor, and he became very disappointed. But even after that disappointment, where he, according to one fairly probably reliable story, he tore up the dedication of the Eroica Symphony to Napoleon. Even after that episode, he sort of found himself coming back into Napoleon's orbit. And there's one letter where he's asking, what do you think? Would Napoleon hire me as his music director in Paris? I mean, can you imagine Beethoven moving to Paris? I mean, he really considered it. Napoleon's brother, Jerome, offered Beethoven a very lucrative position in Kassel, in the Kingdom of Westphalia, that Beethoven almost took. I mean, he gave it serious consideration. But a group of Viennese noblemen put together a fund, a kind of trust fund for Beethoven, from which he could draw, the condition being, you stay in Vienna. So again, I come back to this idea that he was a celebrity. He was really seen as a cultural asset for Vienna. And I think the back and forth with Napoleon would be more typical of Beethoven looking at an object, in this case Napoleon, from many different angles.
Truly a complex and multifaceted human. And I think the same can certainly be said of his music. It's complex and multifaceted, always going to yield something new upon digging a bit deeper, or even coming across it a second time, whether you're reading something about Beethoven again and some detail of his life strikes you, or you're hearing that one piece again and you say, wait, I've never noticed that before. And that all brings me to my final question. What was it that got you started on Beethoven? Was there any moment, performance, movie, biography that prompted you to develop your interest and devote a substantial part of your scholarship to this figure?
Oh, it goes back a long way. My older brother is a really fabulous pianist, and so I'm not. But I grew up in a household where I was hearing Beethoven without even realizing that's what it was. I didn't really pursue it that much. I mean, I loved listening to music, but it was only when I got to college that I realized you could actually major in music, which was a real surprise to me. And then I just began devouring everything I could, not just Beethoven. Personally, I actually started out with Haydn and Mozart, and have sort of worked my way into the 19th century. And there are so many points of connection between the previous generations of artists and Beethoven that I think we overlook. There's one biography from the 1927 centennial called Beethoven, the Man Who Freed Music. And I think that's part of the old myth. No, it was a lot of the works, especially the piano sonatas, I think, that got me into the music. And I'm still discovering music. I can't claim to have heard every last note he's written. And when I listen to the same pieces again, they come to me as new. I've been kind of obsessed lately with the Missa Solemnis, which is a work I think everyone respects, but not that many people really love. And I've found myself falling in love with it just in the last couple of weeks.
Will you be listening to that again to mark the 250th?
It's in my car on the CD, which means that yes, I will be.
Well, Evan, it's been a real pleasure talking with you today. Thanks for the conversation and for all your work and research on Beethoven, and many more happy discoveries to you with the man and his music.
Okay, thank you, Bradley.
Part of a conversation I had with musicologist and professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Mark Evan Bonds. His books, Beethoven, Variations on a Life, and The Beethoven Syndrome, Hearing Music as Autobiography, are in print with Oxford University Press. For South Carolina Public Radio, I'm Bradley Fuller.